uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org, podcast at whiterosesociety.org, and also now from Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Mr. Mike Wright interviewing Mr. Tennant, the director of the CIA, this Michael Wright, Norman, Oklahoma. He says, Mike Wright, Mr. Tennant, Time Magazine reported in June of 2002 about the fact that in August 2001, the FBI headquarters was being confronted with a request from its Minneapolis agents to search the computer of Zacharias Moussaoui. Tennant interrupting, Wright. And then Wright, this is with the W, this is the questioner. I'm just going to say questioner instead of Wright so it doesn't get confusing. Questioner. And reported that the CIA erroneously painted up Moussaoui as to just be a religious extremist. Tennant, interrupting. That's not true. Questioner. But not an al-Qaeda member. Well, obviously it wasn't true. My question to you is, how do you account for that terrible lapse in intelligence in 2001? Tennant. There wasn't a lapse in intelligence. We knew who Moussaoui was all the time. In fact, the FBI came to us to help them since they couldn't get the court authorization or the data to get a judge to authorize it. They came to us for help. We knew exactly who Moussaoui was. The event hostess had removed the microphone, so at this point the questioner had to shout. He says, "What? Did Time Magazine make a mistake?" Tennant, yes, sir, they did. They were absolutely wrong. Now, this, according to Mike Wright, leaves us with three possible conclusions. Number one, Tennant and the CIA knew about Moussaoui's relationship or membership in al-Qaeda and gave an honest report to the FBI. Accepting this as truth would lead to believing that the FBI headquarters mischievously ignored this information and refused to grant permission for the August 2001 computer search. Or number two, Tennant and the CIA knew about Moussaoui's membership in al-Qaeda and lied to the FBI in August of 2001. Telling this lie actually enabled the al-Qaeda 9/11 plot to go forward, and the article in Time magazine was correct. Or number three, Tennant and the CIA were ignorant about Moussaoui at the time of these events. The correspondent, Mr. Wright, says he favors number two. That would be that Tennant and the CIA knew about this, and they lied. The CIA lied to the FBI, and thus 9/11 happened. Good question. Colleen Rowley was one of the early whistleblowers. She blew the whistle on this thing. She's now running for Congress, actually, in her district in Minnesota. Is it Colleen? Yeah, there you go. Colleen
Hello?
Rowley? Yeah. Hey, there you go. Sorry. Had to push the right button. You're running for Congress now in Minnesota?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I just announced my candidacy 6 days ago.
That is so great. I spend so much time on this program telling people, get active, get out there, participate, and here you're doing it. Do you mind if we talk about the CIA and the FBI and this stuff?
We can, and I can maybe generalize just a little, but I can't talk about the Moussaoui case's specifics because there's a court gag order that even affects retired agents. Normally we have to go through pre-publication review. And in this case, it's especially sensitive because Moussaoui's facing an extensive death penalty phase trial.
And therefore, you at the very least, you wouldn't want to prejudice a potential jury, that
Absolutely.
Sort of thing?
Absolutely.
I see. But
I can comment in general about the comments I heard from the questioning of Wright and Tennant. It is true that Tennant knew of this case. This has been publicized in even very early on in news articles, that on the morning of 9/11, when he was having breakfast with a professor of some sort, that someone came running into him and said, a plane has just hit the World Trade Center. And the first words out of George Tennant's mouth was, I wonder if it's that guy taking flight training in Minnesota. So all along, when George Tennant, the thing is, when you know something like this, and again, there were many, many mistakes and errors and issues, endemic problems even, that existed pre-9/11. But what happens is there's a real strong human nature tendency to want to cover those up, gloss over those things, and then, of course, show the American public that, try to make up for, in fact, the earlier lapses. And I think a lot of this now has almost led to people coming up with darker conspiracy theories. Because what it looks like from an objective standpoint is when people don't open up then in a forthright way and admit mistakes and unravel those mistakes and deal with them, to the naked eye, it looks about like a conspiracy would look. Mm-hmm. It looks like somebody deliberately planned these things. And I will say that it is my strong personal opinion that there was no actual what you would call a true conspiracy with intent pre 9/11. But what there was,
you mean within the United States government?
Right. Nothing.
I mean, clearly there was a conspiracy that brought about 9/11.
Exactly. Of course, with the hijackers and
right.
It was an exactly right. It was an Al Qaeda conspiracy, and it was not with some kind of deliberate involvement of our own officials. At least everything I know of, and I do know a lot of the facts in 9/11. But what you do have is you do have mistakes, and you have such an intertwined level of mistakes, you know, possibly thousands. Everyone from visa stampers, you know, they sent a visa to Mohammed Atta 2 months after the attacks. Airport security on the lowest levels all the way up to mid-level people like our lawyers and our FBI, our managers. Even myself, I had a role in not picking up the phone and calling up to our headquarters and finding out what the roadblock was. If I had called, I would have learned that the people that had said they had read this document hadn't even read the document. So it's one of these things that there's a lot of, then besides all of the individual errors, there were long-standing endemic problems, what we call the FISA wall, that prevented sharing of intelligence with law enforcement.
So a fair amount of incompetence and butt covering, it seems, going on. But how, for example, the story that George W. Bush had essentially ordered that our intelligence services in the United States not keep the close eye on the Saudis, that they, particularly the bin Laden family, that they had been keeping on them, and then, you know, allowed them to fly out of the country in at least gather together and be in the air before all the restrictions were lifted, and then fly out of the country immediately after without having to go through INS, without having to be debriefed by the FBI. The FBI apparently wanted to talk to a number of these people. And never has to this day. You know, a lot of folks look at that and go, Bush must have had something to do with it. I mean, my own personal take is that it was bin Laden's half-brother who bailed George Bush out in his first failed oil business, that he and his father are so deep in with the bin Laden family, he was just trying to avoid any embarrassment. But what's your take on it?
Well, Fahrenheit 9/11, which I think actually was pretty darn accurate. I mean, it got criticized for being, some parts of it being a little distorted for dramatic effect. But actually, when you really dissected it all, I thought it was pretty accurate. I think the one thing that perhaps was maybe just a little too far over the edge was this flight of the relatives of bin Laden. And the reason for that is it was many people in government, even to include Richard Clark, that authorized that early planes that took bin Laden.
But why?
Well, I think there actually was a reason that thinking that the backlash of after the attacks could pose a risk to some of these college kids who are...
But at that point in time, Colleen, it had not come out that Osama bin Laden was responsible for this.
Well, that of course, is something that was... That's not true. I mean, people, when this happened, like someone like a George Tenet, when you see the hallmarks of an attack like this, it is immediate to anyone who's half studied the problem that, yes, you're going to wait for proof to prove it in a court of law. Even like with the London bombings now, you
right.
certainly would have to wait for conclusive proof. On the other hand, you make some assumptions early on based on the hallmarks of what you're seeing.
I see.
And in this case, I think very early on, even our affidavit from the start was saying that it was Al-Qaeda related.
How do we balance? And this, I mean, you're going to be running for Congress. These are the real issues, I think, that you're going to be confronting if you win your seat. By the way, are you running as a Republican or a Democrat?
I'm running as an independent-minded Democrat.
Okay.
The incumbent is a two-time Republican who's linked both with Tom DeLay's PAC in a very unethical way, as well as, you know, very much voting lockstep with the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And that's what I am critical of. So, of course, I'm going to be a Democrat because we have to dislodge this type of partisan, you know, far-right partisan support and leaning, which has led us in such a bad direction.
Yeah, well said. We're talking with Colleen Rowley. Colleen Rowley, who, when she was an FBI agent in Minneapolis, her office got a lead just 3 weeks before 9/11. A known Islamic extremist named Zacharias Moussaoui had paid $8,000 in cash to lessons to learn how to fly a Boeing 747. Rowley's team arrested him and wanted a warrant to search his laptop computer, but FBI headquarters said no. After 9/11, Rowley wrote FBI Director Mueller a letter pointing out that no one will ever know the impact the computer search would have had, calling his defense of the agency a rush to judgment to protect the FBI at all costs. She testified before the Senate a few weeks later and was chosen by Time magazine as one of their persons of the year in 2002. Colleen Rowley, how do you balance civil liberties and the needs for effective investigation by local and federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies during this time of this so-called war on terrorism?
Well, I think actually in a personal way, I'm not a very braggadocio person, but I think if there is one thing I can bring to this debate and hopefully be a believable crusader for effective investigation and at the same time preserving civil liberties, it is extremely difficult to come up with the correct balance, because if you clamp down on civil liberties, if you do detentions, for instance, post 9/11 detentions, which kept people locked up and sometimes even beat up for months based on no connection to terrorism. Almost none of the people locked up post 9/11 were ever proven to have any real connection to Al-Qaeda. Now, if you do that, you overreact and your balance goes, the pendulum swings too far in one direction. What is it? You've actually become fighting against. You're actually becoming a lawless entity yourself. And you can't clamp down on civil liberties to the point where that happens, because it's not only just an ethical thing, it's not only a pie in the sky, you know, our constitutional rights, it's also counterproductive to your own cause. You actually increase terrorism by fighting terrorism if you use the wrong mechanisms. The other great example that we can see of mistakes like this was the torture. I mean, it sounds like a good idea to get tough like they are, like the terrorists don't use nice ways. I mean, they use bad ways. So
except it doesn't produce good information.
It produces bad information, and guess what else? Also, it does. It ratchets up the problem. You can't engage in the same bad tactics. So it's a very hard to keep your judicious, well-balanced tactics at the same time as being aggressive and effective.
Well said. Colleen Rowley, running for Congress in the Minnesota's 2nd District against incumbent John Klein. Colleen, do you have a website that you can point folks to?
Yes, it's www.colleenrowley.com, and I would appreciate if anyone would check it out and perhaps even consider contributing financially.
Great. Colleen, good luck. I wish you the very best. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15, there's still time for you. Time to buy and time to lose.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our telephone number, 1-866. Toll free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our chat room, our live chat room, you'll find some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. Looks like a couple of new folks in there as well. And anyhow, welcome back to our program. Rick in Michigan is on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Good interview there, Tom. And I did want to comment on the Karl Rove story yesterday that was on the news wires in the afternoon.
Finally, Karl Rove has moved from the blogosphere. I mean, we've all known about this for a week and a half now.
Well, more than that, but
you know, actually, the first time Joe Wilson came on this program and said it was Karl Rove was almost 2 years ago. But now the mainstream media is saying, oh, gee, Karl Rove, how about that?
We just
discovered something.
I even saw Carl Cameron from Fox actually ask a question that was somewhat incisive. But Fox News, I watched Fox News last night starting with O'Reilly, and I don't think I heard a single thing. I think O'Reilly would rather talk about a jaywalking incident in New Hampshire than about this. But it was interesting that even some of the, like MSNBC, of course, is going a little far to the right, so they weren't talking too much about it. But I think my most favorite was Tucker Carlson, who now works for MSNBC, and has actually come out against the war, I guess, in Iraq. But he says, you know, politically, Rove is probably history. But he says, this is really a non-story. And the way these people are defending Mr. Rove, well, he didn't say the woman's name.
Right.
He didn't do it with the intent. And McClellan is saying, well, this is an ongoing investigation, and we can't.
This is the equivalent of Democrats 4 years ago saying, hey, Bill Clinton, what he does in his sex life is between him and his wife.
That is true, though.
And he didn't technically lie, because some people think that when you say sex, you're talking about intercourse, and other people, when you say sex, you're talking about anything sexual. And where do you draw the line? And when is something sex and when is it not sex? Is kissing sex? Is looking at pornography sex? What is sex? And you know, quack, 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 quack. This is like the way that the Democrats... Some Democrats were trying to defend Bill Clinton. Not very many, frankly. But
well,
nonetheless, my position was always, what does this have to do with national security?
That's the point.
And we have to ask that question here. What does this have to do with national security? Should it matter to the function of the office of the President of the United States and his chief advisor that they are bringing down a counterterrorism operation at the same time they are telling us that we need to be afraid, be very afraid, be even more afraid, be constantly afraid, because them terrorists out there are going to come and get you. But we got to go over there and kill them first, kill 1,700 Americans, young Americans, because we got to make them flypaper to catch those terrorists. You know, it's at the same time that they're saying all this stuff, Karl Rove outing not just a CIA agent, but bringing down an entire CIA counterterrorism operation. Shutting down an entire CIA counterterrorism operation just for political payback, you have to ask the question, is that as much of a crime against we, the people of the United States, as, for example, getting it on with what's-her-name, Monica, in the White House?
Only 1,000% more, probably.
But yeah, or 100,000% more. I mean, it's like the difference between... Well, metaphors escape me. It's just it's night and day, right?
Well, I think old man Bush ought to have a talk with Junior and say, come on, clean up.
Old man Bush tried to have a talk with Junior about the Iraq War. He ended up, Junior said he refused to talk to him. I mean, you don't see Junior vacationing in Kenny Bunkport anymore.
He has a higher father, right?
Right. Well, and then Bill Clinton goes there. I mean, Bill Clinton's the new adopted son. No, Junior says, no thanks. He's not going to. In fact, Clinton, Bush the elder, Bush Sr., had to get his go-to guy, Brent Scowcroft, to write the op-ed piece for the Washington Post before Junior went to war, saying, please don't go to war. If you do, you're going to have a quagmire. You're going to have thousands of dead Americans. It's going to last for years and years and years. You're going to squander the national fortune, and you're going to end up with America hated around the world. Gee, what a surprise.
I never thought I'd say this, but I really wish the old man was back.
Yeah, well, he's certainly the old man at least was a Republican.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to say, I want the Republicans to take back the Republican Party, because we could use a little dialogue here. I really think, you know, I really believe in it. Thanks for the call, Rick. I really believe in the two-party system. I think it's good that we have both parties arguing with each other. But the Republican Party has been taken over by people who are not Republicans. They do not hold the values that are traditional to the Republican Party. These guys are extremists. They are the followers of Leo Strauss, the neocons, and Machiavelli. And it's just terrible what they're doing to this country. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yes, welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The mainstream media in this country are dominated by liberals, writes George McClure in the Denver Post. Yes, nothing but liberals in the mainstream media. That's all you'll find. Turn on any radio anywhere in the country. Nothing but liberals. After all, I was informed of this fact, he notes, by Rush Limbaugh, Thomas Sowell, and Ann Coulter, and Rich Lowry, and Bill O'Reilly, and William Sapphire, and Robert Novak, and William F. Buckley Jr., and George Will, and John Gibson and Michelle Melkin and David Brooks and Tony Snow and Tony Blankley and Fred Barnes and Britt Hume and Larry Kudlow and Sean Hannity and David Horowitz and William Crystal and Hugh Hewitt and Oliver North and Joe Scarborough and Pat Buchanan and John McLaughlin and Cal Thomas and Joe Klein and James Kilpatrick and Tucker Carlson and DeRoy Murdoch and Michael Savage and Charles Krauthammer and Stephen Moore and Alan Keyes and Gary Bauer and Mort Kondracki and Andrew Sullivan and Nicholas von Hoffman and Neil Cavuto and Matt Drudge and Mike Rosen and Dave Koppel and John Caldera. Yes, all these media heroes have told me that there's nothing but liberals in the media. Other than Tom Hartman, can you name one? Oh, Al Franken, yes. Occasionally you'll find him out there, too. Randy Rhodes, one of the finest people in talk radio. Ed Schultz, doing a good job out there. But is this the mainstream media? No, it's talk radio. Well, mainstream media. You know, did you know, for example, that there's an ultra-leftist, this, again, from George McClure in the Denver Post, did you know that there is an ultra-leftist professor at the University of Colorado named Ward Churchill who wrote an essay 3 years ago when she called the victims of 9/11 little Eichmanns? Bet you never heard of him. The liberal media elite likes to put the kibosh on embarrassing stories like this, right? Nobody ever heard of him. Look at how they all gave Bill Clinton a pass on that whole Monica Lewinsky affair. Remember, it was never in the news. We never heard any of the salacious details. The work of his presidency never came to a virtual halt while he defended himself. No, we have a liberal press. They so poisoned the electorate that not a single Republican can get elected. Republicans don't control the presidency or the House or the Senate or 28 of 50 governorships. No, it's because there's liberal media. The Pew Research Center for People in the Press did a report last year that found that 54% of journalists considered themselves moderates. 7% identify themselves as conservatives. 34% identify themselves as liberal. Okay. Now, based on that study, the 54% say they're moderates, 34% say they're liberals. John Gibson of Fox News said, quote, 80-some percent of reporters are self-described liberals, end quote. Rush Limbaugh, quote, most of them journalists are liberals. 80% of them will admit it in the latest poll. Yeah. The liberal press in America. What does it mean to be liberal? John Kennedy had some thoughts on this that I think are worth sharing. Here's JFK on liberal.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with a taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy, I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal. Where are the Democrats among us who would emulate JFK? Where are they? They're all hiding under chairs. They have been beat up so badly by the mainstream media and the conservative, the overwhelmingly conservative mainstream media. Yes, you may have more journalists saying that they are liberals than saying they are conservatives, but the majority call themselves moderates. And the bottom line is, for a journalist, you report the news. but you also report the news for the company that you work for. And, I mean, you know, just try to put a liberal spin on things if you work for Fox News or CBS or NBC or ABC or CNN or MSNBC. Every time I turn on the TV and see Chris Matthews talking to that woman from the New York, was it the New York Post? I can't even, it's, I just, you know, yesterday afternoon I was turning it on and there she was. Just lying. I mean, I'm watching it with my mouth open going, how can this woman say this? Oh, she works for Rupert Murdoch. It's the New York Post, right? I'm pretty sure it was. It's like, yeah. So let's reclaim this word. I am a liberal and proud of it. George Washington was a liberal. Our quote for the day from George Washington, I hope to ever see America in the forefront of liberality. I hope that this nation shall ever become progressively more liberal. Mike in Celebration, Florida on the line. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just got a quick joke for our Republican friends. They've never been able to come back from it. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Osama.
Osama who?
No wonder you guys can't find him.
No, it should be no wonder you guys can't find me. Right?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Did the hurricane get you, Mike?
No, we just kind of brushed by Celebration, Florida. We just got heavy rain. I felt like Captain Nemo in my car here going through some showers, but otherwise we came out okay.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm glad you made it. It looks like it's the beginning of a really ferocious season here.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, Tom, one thing you said while I was waiting on the line, you know, I'm not ashamed to say I'm liberal anymore. I was kind of like a conservative before this Iraq war, and it kind of brought me to my senses, you know, and the thing is, I'm proud to be a liberal. I don't care what anybody says.
God bless you. Good on you, Mike.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Yes, another proud liberal. Fox News Channel special report, July 7th. Jeff Birnbaum. Now, here, actually, let me ask the question before this. Why are the Democrats unwilling, by and large, Democrats unwilling to use what happened in London to make their point? The point being, George Bush is not making us safer. Tony Blair didn't make England safer. Tony Blair went to the British people and said that Osama bin Laden had the power to launch a chemical weapons strike with a 45-minute notice he could hit London. It was a lie. Blair knew it was a lie when he said it. Bush lied to us about the weapons of mass destruction and the threats that they represented. Blair lied to his people. We now have the paperwork from back even before the war showing that they knew that it was a lie, that this was how they had to sell this thing. But, you know, the oil companies, there was some significant revenue to be made out of this. And more important than anything else, George W. Bush thought, hey, if he had a war, he could be a war president. As a war president, he'd get reelected because Americans always reelect presidents during times of war. And this is a reality not lost on Fox News. This as crass and craven as it gets. And I, you know, I suppose you could accuse me of some sort of double standard and saying, why don't the Democrats do this? But the Democrats actually have the correct point. And the Republicans have to spin this, twist it around, and lie about it in order for it to even sound reasonable. And it doesn't. But, I mean, you know, just to even give it a shot, Democrats could simply say, if we hadn't invaded Iraq, there's a good chance that London wouldn't have been bombed. This is not rocket science. You go invade and occupy somebody else's country, they're going to start getting a little upset with you. So anyhow, Jeff Birnbaum, on July 7th, on Fox News, talking about how this is going to help, the attacks in London are going to help George W. Bush in the polls. He says, quote, I think there has been a plunging poll rating for Bush's policies in Iraq, and even for the president's job performance overall, in part because the American people forgot that there really is a war on terror. or they don't believe Bush's often repeated reminders from the stump that, in fact, we are in war and we had to act that way. I think this will. It takes away all the credibility problems that the president has been having, and popular support, I think, will begin to rise for him again. You get this? A bomb goes off in London, and the cons on Fox News are gleefully rubbing their hands and laughing. And, well, of course, you've got, going, oh, boy, time to buy. Brit Hume. But here, Birnbaum, his popular support is going to rise again. Isn't this great? Oh, boy, look at that. The bombing in London is going to help George Bush. Yes, indeed. Let's give him a little momentum. Bill Salmon of the Mooney-owned Washington Times agrees. He says, I think the entire conversation changes now. You know, we were talking about Gitmo and whether the prisoners had sufficient comforts. That debate is obliterated. And now we're back to, guess what, good and evil. I mean, this is what Tony Blair and Jack Straw and all these people were talking about. They're talking about using words like wicked and evil, the words that Bush was mocking for using by his detractors when 9/11 happened. But that's where this conversation's back to. We're not talking about global warming. We're not talking about Gitmo. We're back to the basics. We are at war. We are at a war that we started. That we started. That our policies began. When you occupy a country, people fight back. And in Saudi Arabia, the Saudis, like Osama bin Laden, and keep in mind, Saudi Arabia is where this all began. And we helped install in the 1950s in Saudi Arabia essentially a dictatorship. A dictatorship. The House of Saud, the Saudi royal family. And that dictatorship has been, you know, oppressing its people. I mean, women can't drive in Saudi. You get Laura Bush running. Women could drive in Iraq. Women could work in Iraq. In fact, they did. There were women in all the professions in Iraq. They didn't have to wear veils in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. They could walk the streets freely and safely under Saddam Hussein, as long as they weren't politically active. You get politically active and he'll come after you. The guy was a tyrant, of course. But they had personal freedoms. You get Laura Bush running around the Middle East going, oh, wouldn't it be nice if women had, you know, we've got to go back, take Iraq to a time when women won't have. No, women are now in the burqas in Iraq because the fundamentalists are gaining power in Iraq. And in Saudi Arabia, women have no rights. They're the property of their husbands. They can be beaten up. They can be murdered. They essentially have no rights. Saudi Arabia, we're all upset about beheadings. Every Friday, they have public beheadings in Jeddah and Riyadh. Every Friday afternoon, the public beheadings. Saudi Arabia. The country whose royal family, the Saudi royal family and the Saudis, over the years, over the last 30 years, have given more than $1 billion in direct loans, grants, and investments to the Bush family and business interests aligned with the Bush family. Salman bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's brother, bailed George W. Bush out of his first failed oil company, Ambusto Oil. So, gee. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Ken in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I never watch Fox News, but I got stuck in a diner last night eating, and O'Reilly was on, and he had this political analyst on saying that we didn't have any problems with Korea until Clinton let him build 8 nuclear bombs. When did those bombs get built?
Clinton put a stop to it.
That's on Bush's watch. And
that's right.
And the guy they're trying to put into the UN.
Yeah, Clinton put a stop to it. He negotiated a deal with them where we sold them some grain and we took care of a few other things. And in exchange for that, they totally froze their nuclear program, which had not gone far enough to build a bomb. And they put monitor cameras inside all the facilities. We had 24-hour watch on the outside and on the inside. And they started dismantling that stuff right after George Bush gave his axis of evil speech as president.
I nearly choked on my toast last night. And
O'Reilly just let that slide by?
I'm sorry?
O'Reilly just let that slide by, that guy saying that the bombs were built on Clinton's watch?
Exactly. He didn't only let it fly by. He said, yeah, isn't that right?
This is why Fox's ratings are going in the toilet. This is why Fox News and O'Reilly and Hannity and all these guys, this is why they have half as many viewers as they did a year ago. because people are figuring out that they're getting lies and nonsense from Fox News in greater quantity than the lies and nonsense they get in the mainstream media. And they're saying enough.
What I'm saying is, it just absolutely floored me. I don't get anything from television anymore. I don't have time for television. I get it all right here on this channel, and I can't believe that it's still out there.
Yeah.
But now I believe it.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
It's unfortunate. Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, my goodness. What tangled webs we weave. Is that the old saying? When they practice to deceive. NBC's Joe Scarborough saying any criticism of the White House is now unacceptable. He says earlier today you had Hillary Clinton, senator from New York, coming out and actually criticize George Bush. Criticize our government. Oh, George Bush is our government. Thank you, Joe Scarborough, for that lesson in civics. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See, we got the numbers, but they got the voting machines. Gonna have to turn out like they never seen. Gonna have to win big, gonna have to win clean.
There you go. We got the numbers, but they got the voting machines. Yeah, good old Chuck Hagel, the former president of the company that became ESNS, the voting machine company, who then ran for the Senate in Nebraska after he sold the state his own voting machines and somehow mysteriously won. Gee, what a surprise! Yeah, we got problems, I'm telling you. We got to do something about this. In the by the way, in the third hour of our program today, we are going to have on the former administrator of the United States Social Security program under the Clinton administration, William Halter, who's going to tell you about a new scheme that the Bush administration has turned to try to destroy Social Security. It is hair curling. 1-866-889-8894. We're in the first hour of the program right now. Frank in Phoenix on the line. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was wondering, that agent that the Bush administration outed...
Valerie Plame, yeah.
No, not Valerie Plame, that double agent that was in Al-Qaeda.
Oh, in London you're talking about.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think that he could have made a difference about the bombing, you know, by being able to warn them and all that?
Well, what happened was, because the Bush administration outed the Al-Qaeda agent in England because it was a bad point in the news cycle and they needed some good, you know, they needed some good news, basically, was the bottom line, what they did, and used it during the Bush campaign. And the British were furious about this. They had to run around and scramble like crazy and arrest these guys before the word got out, before they could escape. And some terrorists got away, and others were forewarned. So, yeah, they might have been on the edge of busting up this cell that led to it, but the Bush administration blew it by their hunger for publicity. I mean, they're just, you know, trying to get something good for George. Pat in Iowa in a truck. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey there. I just have one comment about the media.
Yes,
and that is, tyranny can only exist when the right of the people to criticize the government and its minions is denied or abridged.
I agree. And I'll tell you, try and show up at a Bush rally with a John Kerry sign. It doesn't even have to be a No Blood for Oil sign. Just try and show up with a John Kerry sign or a, you know, Vote Democratic sign at a Bush rally. They will arrest your butt if you don't move. I mean, this is what Brett Bercy in North Carolina, this guy got arrested. He walks up, there's a whole long line of people holding Bush for President signs, and he walks up and he holds up a Democratic sign, and they pick him out and they arrest him. And
I'm not surprised.
Strom Thurmond's son, Strom Thurmond Jr., prosecutes him, federal prosecutor prosecutes him. I mean, this is, you're absolutely right, Pat, tyranny is here, and its name is the neocons and the Republican Party. And we'll have more about that coming up. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The place where smart people get their news, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. looking for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, and live 365's American FM, and WhiteRoseSociety.org, where also the program is being podcast there and through Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Bioneers. It's our regular Tuesday segment. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. Bioneers are everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. They herald a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. And our bioneer for the day, Ronnie Cummins. Ronnie is the co-founder and national director of the Organic Consumers Association, the OCA. He's editor of OCA's website and electronic newsletter, Organic Bites, B-Y-T-E-S, lifetime activist and organizer in human rights, anti-war, labor, consumer, and sustainable agriculture campaigns. He has also served as the director of U.S. and international campaigns, such as Pure Food Campaign and the SOS, Save Organic Standards Campaign. Also the author of five children's books and co-author of the book Genetically Engineered Food, A Self-Defense Guide for Consumers. Hey, Ronnie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Glad to have you here with us, Ronnie. People hear organic, and there's a small subset within our culture of people who immediately understand what that means and that it means more nutritious and you know, less likely to cause cancer and so on. I mean, it's just the obvious stuff. But how can the organic food business make the transition from being, or is it in fact in the process of making the transition? It seems to me that it is, but maybe it's because I live in a progressive community like Portland, Oregon. Make the transition from being a fringe product or an early adopter product, to use the language of marketing, into the early and middle mass market. How do we bring about a day when you walk through the aisles of a Kroger or a Walmart that serves food, you know, for those people who can, you know, swallow their ethics and walk into a Walmart, and you find in the aisles row after row after row of organic products?
Well, I think the first thing is for us to be clear about the fact that organic is not some newfangled invention, that in fact traditional agriculture has practiced for about 10,000 years, and traditional animal husbandry, raising of animals, was always organic. It was only about 60 years ago that the U.S. government led the way in a very risky experiment of introducing toxic chemicals and chemical fertilizers into agriculture. And after 60 years of seeing the disastrous impacts of industrial chemical-intensive agriculture and now genetically engineered agriculture, people are turning back to the traditional ways. And so we see now that organics are the fastest growing component of our American food system, about $15 billion in certified organics and billions more in organics that aren't certified are being sold. So we're about 3% now of all grocery store sales. But the way organic is growing at a rate of 20-25% growth a year, whereas regular industrial food is growth is very flat. In about 20 years, the way things are growing, organic will once again become the norm instead of the alternative. But in the meantime, we need to speed up this process. It's pretty clear looking around that public health and the environment cannot stand 20 more years of industrial agriculture and long-distance food transportation and all that that entails. So basically, we've got to vote with our pocketbooks every day for organic and fair trade by, you know, making sure that we purchase organic products, whether it's from your local farmer's market or directly from a farmer in your region or a retail cooperative or natural food store or even where you find organics increasingly in mainstream supermarkets. We've got to put our money where our values lie and cast our votes for health and sustainability and justice. But beyond that, I think consumers, organic consumers in the United States, have been a little bit naive in thinking that, well, if we just try to do the right thing in our daily lives, that everything will turn out all right. That's really not the case. We as organic consumers, and there's 30 million of us now across the United States buying organic food and products on a regular basis, we've got to organize ourselves into a potent political force, not just in the marketplace where we're doing a pretty good job, but in the realm of politics, the political arena. For example, our government, federal government, takes $80 billion of our tax money every year and puts it into the U.S. Department of Agriculture programs. Very few people are thinking about this enormous portion of our federal tax money and what it does, but basically they're taking that $80 billion out of our pockets and they're using it to subsidize factory farms, industrial agriculture, overseas policies of dumping food commodities on impoverished countries, leading to millions of deaths and impoverishment of hundreds of millions. We need to start paying attention to this arcane thing called the Farm Bill and these appropriations that come up every year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture budget's about 20% as large as our entire military budget. And if we will get organized and speak in a collective voice, we can change the way our farm and food federal policies are carried out. And, of course, it's even more important at the state and local level where we have a better chance to gain some power that we organize ourselves into a potent political force.
Ronnie Cummins, one of the challenges to organic products that has historically been made by the proponents of chemical agriculture and genetically engineered agriculture is that there are over 6 billion people on the planet. There's a lot of hungry people. And that without the use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides, and without the use of genetically modified organisms, it won't be possible to feed the world. How do you respond?
Yeah, well, this is a myth perpetrated by industry, specifically the chemical, pesticide, genetic engineering, factory farm lobby, that basically says that you can't feed people without, in the United States, for example, spreading 12 billion pounds of chemical nitrate fertilizers on our farmland and spraying a billion pounds of toxic pesticides. But the fact of the matter, if you look at the research in the United States is carried out by organizations such as the Rodale Institute over the past four decades, you find that organic crop production actually has yields just about as high as conventional. And when you look at the fact that there's a diversity of crops being produced in the same limited area on an organic farm, you know, whereas on a, say, an industrial corn farm, you're just producing corn. On an organic farm, you're producing lots of crops. You're also producing food for the earth so that the earth is nourished and can...
But isn't that, on the one hand, more labor-intensive and, on the other hand, reducing your economies of scale because you can, you know, doing 20 acres of five different things is less efficient than doing 100 acres of one thing?
Well, for example, the Mayans, 1,000 years ago, on an acre of their cropland in Mexico, if you added up the corn, the squash, and the beans that they produced on an acre, it's about as much corn as you'd find in on a quote modern Iowa cornfield that uses enormous amounts of non-renewable energy besides toxic chemicals. But what's most important about organic productivity is that study after study has shown that in the developing world, where there are still over 2 billion farmers and rural villagers living off the land, that organic farming, or traditional farming as I prefer to call it, uses about 50% less energy and chemical inputs expenses than conventional. So it's cheaper for small farmers around the world to grow organic, and the yields are 10 times higher per acre. At least 10 times higher. So literally the only way that we're going to solve the problem of 840 million people going to bed hungry every night is to be able to have policies that enable small and medium-sized farmers around the world to stay on the land, to produce sustainably, and to produce the kind of yields that are only available from, you know, smaller farms, where farmers are paying attention to a diversity of crops, where they're paying attention to the health of the animals,
right,
and where they're growing for their local and regional markets.
We're talking to Ronnie Cummins. Ronnie is the co-founder and national director of the Organic Consumers Association, organicconsumers.org on the internet. And Ronnie, I remember when, you know, 30 years ago when I was a kid in school, reading in the textbooks about how the wonders of science brought about this agricultural revolution that America's farmers can now feed the world. You know, look back on it, it almost seems as if our textbooks must have been written by Monsanto. And just in the last year, I recall a cover story in either Time or Newsweek about the genetically modified rice, you know, the golden rice that has the retinoic acids in it, vitamin A. And it is so pervasive, this idea that, you know, a better living through chemistry. It is so much a part of our culture. How do you challenge it without sounding like a Luddite?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is by carefully choosing our terminology, by pointing out, for example, to Americans and North Americans in general that organic is the traditional way of doing things. But just because something is traditional doesn't mean it's outmoded.
Right. I heard a few minutes ago, I heard you mention conventional agriculture. Instead, shouldn't we exorcise that from our vocabulary and instead start saying chemical agriculture?
Chemical intensive versus traditional ways of doing things. And I think that now there's a mass awareness that we're the unhealthiest population on the earth, even though we have the highest medical costs per capita, that our children are facing learning difficulties, that their obesity and overweight has become an epidemic, that simultaneously with people starving all over the world, 30,000 kids a day, people are getting, you know, less and less healthy. And that this sort of Walmartization of the global economy and this fast foodization, supersize me, tradition, where you use heavy amounts of chemicals and pay no attention to the nutritional values of whole foods and traditional ways of eating. This has got to come to an end. We cannot afford to continue poisoning ourselves and our kids the way it is now.
Well said. We're talking with Ronnie Cummins. Ronnie, thanks so much for being with us. Organicconsumers.org, the website. Ronnie, the co-founder and national director of the Organic Consumers Association, OCA, and editor of their website, Organic Bites. Ronnie, I'll see you at Bioneers.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay.
Keep up the good work.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. You too. Bioneers.org, by the way, the website for Bioneers. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Maybe he did, or maybe he shot down a plane in Pennsylvania. I don't think we'll ever know. Yes, welcome back, my friends. What a crock. The other crock, how many casualties are happening in Iraq? The United Nations has just released this from the Iraqi body count public database. Excuse me. 39,000 Iraqis have been killed as a direct result of combat or armed violence since the U.S.-led invasion, a figure considerably higher than previous estimates, the Swiss Institute reported on Monday. Public database Iraqi body count, by comparison, estimates 22,700 to 25,000. But the new institute from the Geneva-based Graduate Institute of International Studies was released at a UN news conference. It builds on a study published by The Lancet, the British medical journal, last October, which concluded there had been over 100,000 excess deaths in Iraq from all causes since March of 2003. That figure was derived by conducting surveys of Iraqi mortality data during the war and comparing the results to similar data collected before the war. So initially, the British government had rejected the Lancet's conclusion, but now they're going back and looking at this. A total number of direct victims. First of all, they said the 2005 small arms survey generally concluded that conflict deaths from small arms have been vastly underreported in the past, not just in Iraq, but around the globe. They went back and looked at the numbers. How many people are showing up in hospitals? How many people are being buried? Do this based on, not reports, but on mortality, actual measurements of mortality. The likely number of direct victims of such weapons likely totaled 80,000 to 108,000 during 2003, for example, compared to earlier estimates by other researchers of 27,000 to 51,000 deaths from small arms that year. They say one of the problems that they're having such a challenge counting this is because the U.S. government will have nothing to do with counting victims of the war, particularly innocent victims of the war. We're talking here about innocent victims of the war, not about combatants, not about insurgents, not, you know, just innocent victims of the war. And you have to ask yourself, if somebody were occupying, if Canada had occupied the United States, they said, look at that, you've got 10% of the country of Mexico is in the United States. That constitutes an invasion. The United States is being invaded by Canada. That's wrong. We're going to protect those Americans. And Canada invaded the United States and threw out all the illegal Mexican immigrants, sent them back to Canada, and then started setting up military bases all over the United States. Sort of like we invaded Kuwait and threw out Iraq. Or we invaded Iraq and threw out the Ba'athist regime. But in the process, some 100,000, well, you know, Iraq's population is about a third that of the United States. No, it's 10% that of the United States. 30 million versus 300 million. 10% of the United States. So 100,000 deaths in Iraq would be like 1 million Americans. If 1 million Americans, innocent Americans, non-combatants, had died in that kind of a situation, do you think that we would be sitting around saying, oh, well, you know, we ought to do something about this Canadian occupation? I don't think so. I think everybody from the California militia to the Maine militia, I think just average people would be out there with guns in the streets. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of impact is it having on Iraq for us to have killed this many innocent civilians in our invasion and occupation? It's not a war. We're not at war with anybody there. All right, there's not a country that we're at war with in Iraq. It's an occupation, and we're fighting against people who don't want to be occupied. How long can that last? Forever. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. The website, you want to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat and say hi to the folks there. Welcome back to our program. You ever hear of thimerosal, sometimes pronounced timerosal, usually thimerosal? This is a preservative that is put in vaccines. And New York's legislature has passed a ban on it, which will not begin until 2008. and it will only apply to pregnant women and children under the age of 3. And George Pataki is still trying to figure out whether or not he's going to sign it. California, Iowa, and Missouri have already passed such laws. Other states considering it: Florida, Delaware, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Maryland, Nevada, Oregon, Ohio, North Carolina, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Washington, and Utah. Now, why should I care, you may ask? Well, if you're in your 20s, probably about 1 in 10,000 of the children who were born at the same time you were born were autistic. If you're in your 20s, odds are you don't know anybody who's autistic. Or your 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s. Odds are you've never met an autistic person. Because for those people who were born up until 1980, only one out of every 10,000 children was autistic. However, the children being born today, odds are in every single public school, there will be 3 or 4 children who are autistic, depending on the size of the school, of course, because today, out of every 166 children born, one is autistic. Now, what accounts for that difference? I mean, this is something that, they refer to this as statistically significant. First of all, what is autism? Autism is a not particularly well understood condition that seems to be associated with organic changes in the brain, physical changes in the brain that change the way the brain functions, that produce withdrawal, social withdrawal. Autistic people and children tend to be socially dysfunctional, socially withdrawn, sometimes to the point of not absolutely refusing to speak to anybody. Sometimes they don't even begin to speak until they're 5, 10 years old. Sometimes they never speak. Reduced eye contact, repetitive rocking, flapping their hands, bouncing their legs for hours at a time. Violent temper tantrums. Difficulty sleeping. Fear of looking another person in the eye, aversion to eye contact. A weakened immune system. And odd repetitive behaviors such as walking on their toes. Walking on their toes. Now, in infants, these are the symptoms of what's called mercury poisoning. Just classical mercury poisoning has these symptoms in infants. And now we're seeing this exploding. Why? Well, it appears, nobody can say for sure, but it appears that there are some children who are genetically susceptible to mercury. And mercury is used in Timerosal, this preservative that's put in the vaccines. And starting in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the big pharmaceutical companies, because what happened throughout the 80s, there was this aggressive push by the vaccine manufacturers to get the government to say, okay, your child has been getting the diphtheria, now they also have to get the whooping cough, now they also have to get this, now they also have, and to you know, when I was a kid, it was smallpox and that was it. I never got a measles shot, I never got a mumps shot, I got measles and mumps. I never got a chicken pox shot, I got chicken pox. In fact, when I was a kid, if somebody in the neighborhood had one of these childhood diseases, everybody would bring their kids over to play with them so that all the kids would get sick. Because then you have lifelong immunity. And a lot of these diseases, like mumps and chickenpox and measles, no big deal for children. But if you're an adult and you get them, they can render you sterile. They can even kill you. So for generations after generation after generation, these childhood diseases were limited to childhood because everybody made sure that their kids got them. It was our own homegrown immunization system. The problem with it? It was free. Nobody could make money off it. So the pharmaceutical companies came up with the vaccines. Now, the problem with the vaccines is twofold. One, they only last for a few years. You've got to get boosters. Well, that's really not a problem from the vaccine company's point of view. And two, there has to be some kind of preservative in there to keep bacteria and mold and stuff from growing in these vials if you want to have any kind of decent shelf life. And so they came up with a preservative that's a compound derived from mercury. Mercury is very, very toxic stuff. It's deadly poison. It's also a neurotoxin. That is, it's destructive to the nervous system. So thimerosal makes vaccines easier to produce, cheaper to produce. You contaminate them with thimerosal, and even throughout the production process, you don't have to worry about anything growing in them. It's easier to store, longer shelf life. In 1991, that is 14 years ago, the LA Times published a memo that had been circulated inside the offices, a secret internal confidential memo inside the offices of Merck Company. And according to an article by John Hanchette, the Niagara Falls Reporter, it showed real concern among senior executives over the significant level of mercury in many children's vaccines. So in 1999, 6 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Public Health Service, the Federal Public Health Service, issued a joint statement urging pharmaceutical firms to take thimerosal out of their vaccines for infants. So what did we do with all that vaccine? What did our pharmaceutical manufacturers, what did the corporations that had already manufactured vaccine for infants containing thimerosal do with all that vaccine? They sold it to China and other developing countries. And guess what has happened in China? There is now an epidemic of autism. Now, to make this even stranger, to make this whole thing even stranger, we have a piece of legislation, a piece of law, slipped in that said that the manufacturers of thimerosal cannot be held accountable for this. Even if they knew about it, even if they intended to protect it. In fact, George Bush, when he was running for president, he said that he was in favor of taking thimerosal out of vaccines and doing something about autism. He's done nothing. There's a parent group, Unlocking Autism. They've unleashed an absolute campaign accusing W of flip-flopping on this. They tried to talk to the White House. Don't want to talk to them. But this little piece of legislation that says that you can't sue the big pharmaceutical companies if your kid gets autism because of thimerosal. This got snuck into the Homeland Security Office Act, excuse me, the Homeland Security Act. You get this? The legislation that enabled the Department of Homeland Security had slipped into it a thing that said, if your child gets autism from having a vaccine that contains thimerosal, the manufacturer of thimerosal, Eli Lilly, among others, cannot be sued. You can't sue them. Sorry, you're just a peon, just a citizen. You can't sue this big corporation. Who slipped that piece of legislation in? Well, to this day, we're not absolutely certain, but it looks like it was Bill Frist. And when he got outed for it, in fact, this legislation says that Eli Lilly can't even be subpoenaed in connection with vaccine lawsuits. They can't even be brought into court to testify. Right after that, Eli Lilly donated $10,000 to Bill Frist's campaign fund. Bill Frist's office says vaccine-damaged lawsuits, quote, are of such magnitude that they could put vaccine producers out of business and limit our capacity to deal with a biological attack by terrorists, end quote. Right. Maybe that's why the pharmaceutical companies, the drug companies, have donated more than $900,000 to Bill Frist. I have a problem with this. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Chicago, you apparently don't have a problem with it.
Tom.
Yeah.
Nice to speak to you. Well, I do have some experience with immunizations of children. I'm a pediatrician and an internal medicine physician. I'm board certified. And I've been taking care of kids for about 10 years. Just a couple of things that I'm not sure if you're aware of. First of all, we don't give any immunizations that contain thimerosal. We haven't for many years.
We haven't for 6 years.
Right. Well, we have it for longer than that. It hasn't been available for many years, let's put it that way. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is very aware of this.
Right, but also, that was in 99 that that became publicized.
That's true. And you do make some a logical argument in the sense that, you know, we're giving this preservative, this thimerosal, which is a mercury-containing substance. It doesn't make sense to give this to people. I agree with that. But what I'd like you to comment on is where in the literature, in any peer-reviewed article that you can find in the medical literature to support your theory that this thimerosal actually causes autism. I agree that the autism is on the rise, but show me the literature that actually gives us a direct link between the two.
Well, I'm not representing myself here as an expert on this. I'm just sharing with you this story in the news. I mean, this...
Well, it is a story in the news.
How do you account for the fact that over a 15-year, 20-year period, we went from autism being 1 in 10,000 to being 1 in 166 births?
Tom, it is a question that physicians are looking at closely. Believe me, we do not want to give kids autism. There's no question about that. We want to do what's absolutely safe for a patient.
So what do you think is causing it?
Well, I mean, autism has a broader definition as far as diagnosing it than it used to. So, you know, there's milder forms of it that we may be recognizing now that we weren't recognizing before. That's always been brought up as a possibility. The other thing, too, though, is, you know, we really have to look at the value of immunizations in general. I mean, it's not just thimerosal, but the measles, mumps, and rubella has been brought up, and I've had parents who've told me that they don't want this given to their children, but we have to look at the actual side effects of having measles. It's not as a benign illness as you had stated. I mean, there's definitely meningitis involved with this. There's a lot of secondary effects of the measles, and we're, you know, we don't see that like we used to before. So,
if the side effect of the vaccine is that 1 out of 166 kids get autism,
not for measles, mumps, and rubella, absolutely not. There has been
you don't know what's causing it.
Well, there actually has been. There's actually been population studies looking at countries where there is more socialized medicine. For instance, Denmark, and you know there's hundreds of thousands of children that are receiving these immunizations. And they cannot find a direct link between the immunizations. For instance, looking at a population of X amount of children that received it and X amount of children that didn't receive it, and they can't find any difference between the populations of children that received measles, mumps, and rubella versus children that didn't receive it. It's not there. So there hasn't been a direct link in the medical any of the medical journals
with that
yet.
Specific MMR vaccine.
With specific MMR, or thimerosal also. I mean, it doesn't make sense to give people a mercury-based compound, even though there isn't any direct evidence. It's still not a good idea. I don't think anyone will disagree with that. But to say that we don't need to be giving our kids measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines, that's a different story. There's a lot of side effects associated with the measles per se.
Yeah, I'm not speaking of this specific vaccine, but I'm assuming that you saw the studies that came out a year or so ago about mercury in hair of children who have autism versus children who don't. They actually had lower mercury levels in their hair.
I'm not familiar with that study. But the question is you know, if that's the case, you know, and we have children now that, you know, like I said, I've been practicing for over 10 years. I've never given thimerosal at all. So if I don't know where those populations were based off of, but there's a lot less thimerosal given. In fact, there's none given now. in any of the immunizations that we use. So the question
to infants.
Is, well, the question, no, to everybody. We do not have any.
There's Thimerosal in the flu vaccine that was available last year.
It's possible.
No, I stated as a fact. I had somebody on this program talking about it. You know, somebody who was involved in the business of it.
Well, I can't comment on it. I'm sorry.
They said
use FluMist now. There's multiple manufacturers for this, and I'm not going to comment on it. But for our routine immunizations, we do not give Flamerosal.
Well, good on you. Good on you. Thank you for setting the record straight. I appreciate
it,
Paul.
All right. Okay.
Thanks for the call. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Tom Hartman with you. TomHartman.com, the website. Why did Bill Frist feel the need to slip into the Homeland Security Act a bill saying that Eli Lilly could not even be subpoenaed in court about Thimerosal? 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by just upon a smile.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 4.5 minutes before the hour, actually. The compound that makes curry yellow. Curry, the spice, the stuff that is in, you know, Indian food and some Asian foods, curries. The stuff that makes them yellow is called curcumin. It's from turmeric. And there's just been some absolutely remarkable science on this stuff. And I know somebody who was diagnosed three years ago at least, with mesothelioma, a lung cancer that is supposed to kill you in three to six months. In fact, they did surgery and said, can't do anything about this, and sewed him up and sent him home. He's been taking curcumin, still alive, still doing well. Just Google curcumin and cancer. It's just remarkable. I mean, good, solid studies that have been done. They're using it now against Alzheimer's. They discovered that people from India who were eating traditional Indian diets were not getting Alzheimer's. Now, it might not be curative, but using it to prevent Alzheimer's is part of a diet thing. But now here, this is from Reuters. This is just mainstream media. This is not from, you know, Rodale or Health Food News or anything like that. It's Reuters. The compound that makes curry yellow could help fight skin cancer, U.S. researchers reported on Monday. They said curcumin, found in spiced turmeric, interferes with melanoma cells. Curcumin made melanoma skin cancer cells more likely to self-destruct in a process known as apoptosis. Same team has found that curcumin helps stop the spread of breast cancer tumor cells to the lungs of mice. This was a study that was done at the Anderson Cancer Center in Houston and the University of Texas. They treated three batches of melanoma cells known as cell lines with curcumin at different doses and for varying times. The curcumin suppressed two proteins the tumor cells used to keep themselves immortal, researchers write in next month's issue of the journal Cancer. Based on our studies, Agarwal said, this is one of the researchers, we conclude that curcumin is a potent suppressor of cell viability and inducer of apoptosis in melanoma cell lines. And they say, yeah, we need to look into more of this. It's also an antioxidant, so it can help tumors from forming in the laboratory. This is from earlier research on curcumin. It's about time to be sure to get your curry when you go to the Indian restaurant or the Thai restaurant tonight. It's good for you. So, you know, fish helps your brain, they say. Curry keeps away the cancer. It's amazing. Just a good, wide, varied diet. Not something you're going to find in our public schools where it's Coca-Cola, the vending machines, and fast food. That's a whole other rant. Anyhow. Time to wake up, my friends. It's Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back to the third hour of our program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, also podcasting from WhiteRoseSociety.org, and Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. What's up with Social Security? Will the cons figure out a way to completely destroy the Social Security program? It's been the goal of the Republican Party ever since the 1930s when Social Security was first passed. It's socialism, after all, the Republicans said. How dare those Democrats enact socialism? This is the beginning of America's slide into communism. They've been at it ever since. Trying to roll back the New Deal, roll back labor protections. Taft-Hartley passed in 1947 over the veto Harry Truman. There you go, Harry Truman's veto, and it's just on and on and on. It's like absolutely anything that serves the public good, it seems, is socialism. That's something to be destroyed. So now we have a new attack on Social Security. The DeMint plan. United States Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina. This is being promoted as a defeat for the Bushies. And maybe not. William Halter is the former Social Security Administrator, the Administrator of the Social Security Administration under the Clinton Administration. Mr. Halter, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Tom, thanks for having me.
I'm pleased and honored to have you on here, sir. Tell us about the DeMint plan.
Well, the basic outlines of the DeMint plan are to take the surpluses that the Social Security system is currently running and to transfer those into private accounts. The problem with the plan, Tom, is that it does absolutely nothing to enhance Social Security. It actually shortens the life of the trust fund. But in addition to that, it would add more than $1 trillion to our national debt in the first 10 years. And in the next 10 years, it would add $600 billion more to our national debt. And as you know well, fiscal policy over the course of the last 5 years has not been a positive one. We went from running very large surpluses in the federal government at the end of the Clinton administration to now running extraordinarily large deficits. The net swing in our fiscal policy over the last 5 years from what it was projected to be to what it currently is a total of $10 trillion of indebtedness. We were actually going to pay off our national debt, and now we're on a path to add $5 trillion more to it over the last 5 years as a result of the policies put in place in the last 5 years and how they will play themselves out in the future. And the DeMint plan would add to that debt and do absolutely nothing to help the Social Security Trust Fund.
Let me just play a quick clip. This is 7 seconds of another radio talk show host talking. This is the real agenda, in my opinion. Absolutely just rolling back the New Deal. Here we are, Rush Limbaugh.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
There you go.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. You know, I try not to get into polemics on these things, but and focus more on the facts. But I don't think there's anyone that can argue that the privatization bills that have been put on the table would do anything over the next decade, 2 decades, or 3 decades, but add to our national debt. In addition to that, depending upon the size of the privatization, they would shorten, not lengthen, the life of the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right. Now, William Halter, former administrator for the Social Security Administration, I'm reluctant to even characterize this as liberal and conservative because Barry Goldwater was in favor of Social Security. Dwight Eisenhower was an advocate of Social Security.
Absolutely right.
I mean, the people who are opposed to it, in my mind, are radicals. They're not conservatives. And the people who are supporting it are taking just simply the position that most Americans, regardless of political stripe, have taken since the 1930s. And before that, for that matter, when they wanted it. I mean, Social Security didn't come about in a vacuum. It wasn't because somebody thought it was a cool idea. It was because there was a need for it.
Right.
But on the one side, the pro don't mess with Social Security folks, they say, don't worry, the Social Security Trust Fund, even though its money is in the form of IOUs, that is treasuries, these special kinds of treasuries, what happened was up until 1982, or 81 or 82, it was always a pay-as-you-go program. In fact, it still is. Today's beneficiaries are receiving their money from today's workers. It's always been a pay-as-you-go program. But back in the early 80s, looking out 40 years, the actuaries said, you know, there's this rabbit going through the python. There's this bulge that's going to be going through the snake, of the finances of the Social Security Administration. A one-generation bulge, the baby boomers, you know, all these babies that were born when their fathers came back from World War II, and there was this explosion of births. And so we're going to do something that's never been done before. And please correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to lay this out and make sure that I understand it correctly. And sure. Hopefully our listeners will get this, too. We're going to do something we've never done before with Social Security. Rather than having today's workers pay for their father's and mother's retirement and their grandparents' retirement, rather than having today's workers pay for the previous generation's retirement, we're going to have today's workers pay for their own retirement by increasing the Social Security tax and taking that money that the baby boomers are paying in additional Social Security taxes and putting that in a savings account, which we won't begin to draw down until those same baby boomers begin to retire. So when the baby boomers are going to begin to retire, they're going to actually be drawing against a savings account that they themselves have accumulated over a 30-year period and pay for their retirement with their own money that they paid into the system. And then when the boomers are all dead, the rabbit will have finished its way through the python, and Social Security can go back to a pay-as-you-go program. Is that an accurate characterization?
It is close to accurate, Tom. You should insert the word partially pay for.
Right.
Because what we were doing, and this was the Greenspan reforms instituted in 1983 on a bipartisan basis, the desire was that we accumulate a surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund, which we have done and which we are still doing, and it is quite a large surplus. And the underlying rationale was that if you have savings that goes on in the economy today and over the past 20 years, that would be the best possible preparation both for the economy and for the Social Security system to be able to pay those benefits for that large generation of retirees, the baby boom generation.
Right. Now, here's where it gets problematic or confusing to some of us. We have almost $2 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund, the savings account that was established in 1983 out of the 82 Greenspan Moynihan Commission. And that money is there to help pay for, as you said, to partially pay for the retirement of the baby boomers who actually paid in that money in the first place.
Right.
The question is, well, here's the position that Robbie Batra posits in his book Greenspan's Fraud. He suggests that Reagan in the 1980s, when he wanted to have massive tax cuts for the wealthy in the United States and do a massive increase in military spending, particularly in Star Wars area, there was no way he could finance that without throwing the country into bankruptcy. So what he did, on the advice of Alan Greenspan, actually, was start borrowing from that Social Security Trust Fund. And by doing that, he was able to increase the taxes on working people, and because Social Security taxes are only paid by, at that time, only paid by people making under $30,000 a year, now it's $90,000, take that tax money and borrow it and use it in the general fund to pay for, you know, his other programs and thus allow him to have his tax cuts at the top bracket. And what's happened is that, excuse me, from that time until now, we have now no money in the trust fund. We just have a lot of IOUs, as George Bush pointed out the other day. And the question is, if the Social Security Trust Fund was to say to the federal government, to the general fund, okay, time to pay back $2 trillion, where's the money going to come from?
Well, look, Tom, there's a lot that you said that I agree with, but there's some things that I have to correct a little bit.
Please.
First, those treasury securities are the safest, soundest, risk-free asset on the planet. They do sit there, they exist, and I am very confident that when the Social Security Administrator in future years turns those treasuries back to the general fund and expects payment for Social Security benefits, that that will in fact happen. I can't imagine a set of circumstances in which a United States president and a United States Congress allows a default on treasuries.
Right, but they would have to massively increase taxes or cut benefits and government programs in order to do it, would they not?
They would have to do one of three things, either raise taxes or have other tax receipts coming in, funded out of the general fund, or as you say, they could cut spending someplace else. They could also borrow on the open market. Now, my problem...
Roll the debt forward, in other words.
Correct. And my problem with what has happened is that we should have been, as a country, on a path to actually pay down our national debt as we prepare for the retirement of the baby boom generation. We could have done that had those Social Security receipts not been used to offset other general government expenditures, if, in fact, we had been running surpluses or at least balanced the budget in terms of the federal government.
Right.
Now, I would point out though that we were on that path as little as 5 years ago.
Right.
Recall in 1999 and in 2000, we ran a very significant federal budget surplus, and we were paying down the national debt. And in fact, a key player in all of this, Alan Greenspan, asked the Federal Reserve staff. And this is hard to believe today, but he actually asked the Federal Reserve staff at that point to look into how the U.S. would conduct monetary policy if we didn't have any Treasury securities out on the market because we had completely paid down our national debt. I would love to be back in that set of circumstances today as opposed to where we are, where, in fact, the debt is going up every day rather than going down every day.
Yeah, this is why Al Gore was talking about the lockbox for the Social Security Trust Fund and trying to separate these things out and having a balanced budget, in which, ironically, he was using the same kind of rhetoric that Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen were using a generation earlier. We have about a minute left here. We're talking with William Halter, the former administrator of the Social Security Administration of the Clinton administration. What's the solution, Mr. Halter?
Well, I think that to get a Social Security reform, you have to look to history. Let's look back to 83 or even previous reforms. You'll see that in every set of circumstances, these major reforms were conducted on a bipartisan basis, and I think that's the first thing that we have to return to here. Now, there's one political party out there that has said, take privatization off the table, take proposals that undermine the Social Security system off the table, and we will come to the table and negotiate a bipartisan reform. I think if you look to history, that's the way that this has to be done.
And hopefully it can be done again. I fear that we have so many ideologues who believe, as Limbaugh said, you know, who believe that Social Security is creeping socialism and therefore must be destroyed, that it ain't going to happen. But, well, you know, hopefully it will.
Solutions to Social Security are going to have to come from the middle, Tom.
There you go. Well said. William Halter, former Social Security Administrator under the Clinton administration. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Have a fine day. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way.
Oh, yeah.
He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft.
There you go. Welcome back. It's 24 minutes, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Hank is on the line. Hey, Hank, what's up?
Well, going back to your conversation the last hour on turmeric.
Yeah. It wasn't so much a conversation. I was just sharing a news story, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, about 10, 12 years ago, I ran into an elderly woman in an Indian food store, and I was looking for a couple of products in there, and got to yakking with her, and she said, oh, she's been over to India and all this other stuff, but she deals with a bunch of AIDS victims, HIV victims, and I said, oh, really? Well, do you give them turmeric? She said, what? I said, I happened to have read an article, a study that showed that turmeric was the thumbprint that blocked the HIV virus, you know. And so I said, here, you're right in the store where it is. Go for it. I've got that study somewhere. If I can run across it, I'll dig it out. And
you mean it prevents the virus from attaching itself to a cell, or it prevents it?
It stops it in dead tracks.
Huh.
Now, what's interesting is recently I heard that in India there's a high, increase in HIV.
It's exploding right now.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm wondering whether they're getting on the American diet and aren't eating enough of their own, turmeric.
Yeah, or it may be that, turmeric's capabilities are exaggerated. It may be that, in vitro it's
in a petri dish it works. Well, this showed the molecular structure of what HIV looks like, and it showed what blocked it in the turmeric,
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, good.
Thanks,
Sam. Oh, also on the mercury and all these vaccines, of course, chlorella. I'm surprised you didn't mention that. Helps dig that out of your body.
Yeah, there's a lot of chelating agents out there, I guess. One of the one study that I saw last year, it was published in Science News. I forget where it was originally published. Said that they were finding in autistic kids lower levels of mercury in their hair, which meant that they weren't excreting it. At first they thought they had lower levels in their body, but they found higher levels in their blood. They weren't excreting it. Now they're thinking that there might be a genetic vulnerability that's associated with that. But that's a whole other thing. Ellen Ratner is with us, our correspondent from Washington, D.C., the Tom Hartman Radio Show's official bureau chief there, right, Ellen?
No.
Oh, no. It's not Ellen.
No, it's that other one.
Who? Oh, it's that other one. Well, it's our unofficial other one. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
I can't. I'm just baffled. Your British accent and everything, and Scott thought you were Ellen.
I know. Well, it was Ellen, and then we're standing there, and we switched phones.
Oh,
so
I see. Okay.
And now it's me.
Okay. So. So what's up?
I was in the belly of the beast today.
Yeah, so what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, my goodness me. It's all action on Capitol Hill. Senior Democrats, it was like future and past presidential hopefuls, Lieberman, Kerry, Clinton, Biden, Schumer, they're all standing there with Samantha Kaka, although I don't think he is, to talk about Homeland Security spending. And what's not being done, amendments that they're offering on this Homeland Security bill, and really some quite chilling statistics. In addition, both Senators Clinton and Kerry made the points. Others did too. Biden was very impassioned. He's always good value. Clinton kept saying that it was a lack of leadership. And I couldn't help thinking to myself, who would you like to see in that leadership position, Senator Clinton?
Yeah.
I didn't say that.
Odds maker is going to touch that, Victoria.
Right, exactly.
You're not going to make any money with that bet.
No, I don't think so. And then Senator Kerry was saying, because she was saying they're more interested in something, in tax cuts than doing this. Kerry says, that they were more interested in saving jobs at the White House than in doing this. And so somebody asked him, it wasn't me, I asked a different question, whether he was referring to Karl Rove.
Right.
And what he thought about that. And so basically Kerry said that, he thinks he should resign, and he was pretty ticked off about the whole thing.
Wow. John Kerry gets a spine.
Yes, I could almost see him lengthening out, and he's a lengthy guy.
If only it had happened a year earlier.
Exactly.
Oh, well, okay. Well, thank you for the report, Victoria, from the belly of the beast.
Thanks very much.
Our report from Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones. Well done. Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And dare to say, nah, don't think so.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Karl Rove's smear campaign continues. This is from the Think Progress blog, one of the better blogs out there, thinkprogress.org, if you want to get to it. In the press conference this afternoon, Christie Post's reporter Terry Moran grilled White House, this is from, presumably from yesterday, I'm assuming, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan about recent talking points attacking Joe Wilson, which contained information which could only have come from Karl Rove. It was immediately back to the no-comment defense for McClellan. Moran, Fox News and other surrogates are essentially saying that the conversation lasted for 2 minutes and that the subject was ostensibly welfare reform. They're getting that information from here, from Karl Rove. McClellan. And again, you're asking questions that are related to news reports that are about an ongoing continuing investigation, and you've had my response on that. Yeah. So here we have the White House shutting up at the same time that Fox News, their official surrogate, the official propaganda arm of the Republican Party, is out there, the unofficial propaganda arm of the Republican Party, is out there trying to spread disinformation. Oh, it was only a 2-minute conversation. Well, how long does it take to out a CIA agent? Just a short one. ABC News, parroting Rove's legal spin. Now it's seeping into the media. Here's CBS's Hannah Storm this morning. Quote, well, he didn't leak the name. What he said was that his wife worked for the agency. That may be a distinction without a difference for some, but I think legally there probably is a distinction. End quote. Yeah, right. ABC News pointing out, Joe Wilson's wife works for the CIA. Wilson's wife works for the CIA. This is what all the right-wingers are saying. All the right-wingers are running around saying, if he had said, Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, is a CIA agent, he would have broken the law. But because he simply said, Joe Wilson's wife is a CIA agent, he didn't break the law because he didn't name her. Well, let's look at the law. This is Section 421 of the U.S. Code, the part that deals with outing agents. Whoever, as a result of having authorized access to classified information, learns the identity of a covert agent, and now listen very carefully and see if what the law says is you must say their name. Whoever, as a result of having authorized access to classified information, learns the identity of a covert agent and intentionally discloses any information identifying some such covert agent to any individual not authorized to receive classified information, blah-de-blah-de-blah, shall be fined not more than $25,000 nor imprisoned no more than 5 years or both. So all the right-wingers are running around saying, well, he didn't say her name. But if you read the law, it doesn't matter. Why do the right-wingers want to make that distinction? Because they got nothing else to hang their hat on. They're making up laws so that they can say they complied with those laws. Go figure. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Eileen in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Eileen.
You were talking with the newswoman from Washington about John Kerry and growing a spine.
Yes.
About Karl Rove. I received two emails yesterday and one today from John Kerry, the friends of John Kerry, but signed by John Kerry, to sign petitions to fire Karl Rove.
Yeah, I received those also.
Yeah, and I don't really think it's that he's growing a spine. I think that he's just going to run for president again in 2008, and I don't really want him to.
Yeah, I think most Democrats don't want him to either. I mean, frankly, my opinion is that he actually won the election.
I believe that, too.
You know, I think the exit polls were right and that there's 5 million missing votes. In fact, when the U.S. Census Department came out with their statistics on the number of people who voted in the last election, mysteriously, it was 5 million votes off. They showed that there were 5 million more people voted than the voting machines counted. And that would account for the fact that the exit polls showed that John Kerry won by 3 million votes, but then the machines show that George Bush won by 2 million votes, and there's a 5 million vote difference. And,
right.
You know, I'm convinced that there was fraud, but people call me, you know, a nut job for that or you know, a conspiracy freak.
No, I believe that, too. I've read John Conyers' book, you know, what went wrong in Ohio, and I definitely believe it.
Yeah, it is so conspicuous. It's
right,
like,
but John Kerry didn't fight for it, and that, you know, he wouldn't fight for it, and as far as I'm concerned, it's too late now. I mean,
yep, me too.
Gore didn't fight either, but, you know, he had the decency not to run again, and I don't think John Kerry should run either.
Yeah, I agree. This, he's blown it. He's just absolutely blown it. The biggest crime, as it were, that John Kerry committed, and just speaking personally here, not even as a commentator, just this is my own personal gut response, was when he gave us these long platitudes before the election day about how he's not going to let Florida happen again. If there's any problems, he's got an army of lawyers. We all I actually contributed money to that army of lawyers.
Right.
And you know, and it wasn't a lot. I mean, I think I sent him $25, but it was a token. You know, I figured if a million of us do that, he's going to have a lot of money. So, you know, it's like I'm putting my money where my mouth is. I'm telling people every time these guys do something right, send them a small donation. Every time Howard Dean gets out there and really gives them hell, I send $10 to the DNC.
Yeah,
I just want them to know about it.
Right. I've donated to them, too.
Right.
And I really have a lot of respect for Howard Dean.
Yeah, me too. And so when John Kerry, after all of that posturing about how he's going to stand firm and he's going to fight this thing, and then it looks like Ohio went to George Bush. Oh, really? Okay, well, see you later.
Yeah, right.
And
he didn't even fight during the campaign. Every time Bush would get out there and talk about him being a flip-flopper, or the Swift Boat guys would talk about his record, he should have been right back fighting back.
Yeah, he should have actually been on the attack, because when you find yourself explaining, you've already lost, and that's most of what he was doing. He should have been forcing George Bush to explain himself. Eileen, thanks a lot for the call.
I just had one more comment.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I think his wife is the one that has spine.
Yeah,
maybe
absolutely.
She should have been the one that ran for president.
Teresa, yeah, except that she can't because she was born in Africa.
Right.
But
I know.
She would have made a great first lady, too.
Yes, I believe so.
I think that we need another Eleanor Roosevelt. We need another outspoken first lady. It's time.
I agree.
Eileen, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to us there on WPTT in Pittsburgh. Since Robert Bork's nomination for the Supreme Court went down in 87, it's become a phrase borked, right? This word has gone into the lexicon. And the right wing is still upset about that. I mean, they're still upset about that. As, for example, in the Washington Post, Sean Rustin, executive director of the Committee for Justice. Where did they come up with these names? These right wingers. This formed to support President Bush's judicial nominees, the Committee for Justice. He says, Robert Bork represented the moment when the left decided that they were not going to defer to the president and allowing him to make over the court, and we've been at war ever since. Right. Robert Bork, who suggested that whatever the founders had in mind when they wrote the Constitution, that's what it should be today. In other words, no time has passed. In other words, if the founders thought that women should not have rights, women should not have rights. If the founders thought that blacks should be slaves, then blacks should be slaves. If the founders thought that only males who own land should be able to vote, then only males who own land should be able to vote. If the founders thought there shouldn't be a national bank, then there shouldn't be a national banker. If the founders thought there should be, then there should be. If the founders thought that there shouldn't be Social Security, then there shouldn't be Social Security. Now, here's where it gets really weird. Abortion was legal in the United States. Legal in the United States. For at least the first 100 years of this country. So the founders thought abortion should be legal. Abortions were not uncommon in the Revolutionary era. I mean, they weren't common, but it was not uncommon. Surgical abortion is not rocket science. And there were a lot of abortifacient herbs, and there were specific over-the-counter remedies, you know, snake oil formulas and whatnot that were sold that contained tansy and rue and other herbs that cause abortions. Very unhealthy things. You know, but that was the state of the art of medicine in 1787. This is the question. I don't get it why they're not asking this question. Why the Democrats are not saying, okay, with regard to abortion, let's go back to the intent of the founders. The intent of the founders was that abortion is something that's between a woman and her doctor. It wasn't until like the 1930s, 1940s that state legislatures started getting in on the act and saying, oh, we can't allow women to do this. So why don't they say to one of these cons, do you believe in strict constructionism? Do you believe in interpreting the Constitution as the founders intended it? Do you think that we should go back to completely decriminalizing abortion because it was decriminalized when the founders signed the Constitution? And then you want to go them one further, say, and when the founders were around, pot was legal, and so was opium. In fact, pretty much everything was legal. Coca-Cola, 1919. It was named Coca-Cola because it was a soft drink that contained cocaine. Clearly that had been legal for over 150 years in the United States. It must be what the founders intended. So you strict constructionists, you intent of the founders folks. I mean, that was Bork's whole thing. Arlen Specter, I've seen Arlen Specter interviewed at least four times. Arlen Specter was on the Senate Judiciary Committee when Bork came before them. He voted against Bork, the Republican, Arlen Specter. And he says the reason why? Because Bork would have taken us back before Brown versus Board of Education. He considered that judicial activism to forcibly integrate schools. Supreme Court can't do that. Now, you can make an argument, and the conservatives do. This is the main argument that right-wingers will make on this. The serious, thoughtful, ideological, doctrinaire pseudo-conservatives or neoconservatives will make this argument. They will say the Supreme Court should not, and by the way, this is Scalia's argument and Thomas's. The Supreme Court should not be creating laws. If the people of the United States want abortion to be legal or illegal, they should pass a law allowing or disallowing it. Pure and simple. If the people of the United States want African Americans to have equal rights to education, they should pass a law. If they want discrimination to be illegal, they should pass a law. It's not up to the Supreme Court to decide it. That's the position that they take, that the so-called strict constructionists take. And, you know, arguably, there's some, you know, philosophically, there's some merit to that. And, you know, the area where they're the most hysterical about this, of course, is the possibility that a Supreme Court, some future Supreme Court, following on the Texas sodomy case, may say, hey, you know, if private sexual activity between adults, regardless of its nature, is entirely legal, that the state has no business going into people's bedroom and determining whether they're having the appropriate type of sex with the appropriate person as long as they're consenting adults. If that's the case, then, you know, why are we making it that gays can't get married? And that the federal Supreme Court will make the same decision that the Vermont Supreme Court did, which led to civil unions, or that the Massachusetts Supreme Court did, which led to marriages of gays in Massachusetts. And they're just terrified that the Supreme Court might say, hey, you know, this is the way it's going to be. But that, of course, their fear. But, and that's why they say the Supreme Court should not be making laws. But the reality is that when the Supreme Court, historically, when the Supreme Court has actually staked out a position and said, no, we are going to be activists, you may say. Probably the single largest act of judicial activism in the 20th century was not Roe v. Wade. It was Brown versus Board of Education. Because Roe v. Wade was just rolling back something that was relatively recent and was affirming the constitutional principle that went back to the founding of this country. that everybody should have rights, that men and women should have equal access to rights. And people say, well, no, I thought that the founders said only white male landowners could have rights. No, actually, that's not the case. Many of the states said that only white male landowners could have rights or could vote. At the federal level, women have always had access to the rights. Until 1787, the Bradwell versus state of Illinois case. But, you know, if you go back and you look at the intent of the founders, it was that eventually all persons would have rights. Jefferson was very explicit about it. He thought, this, you know, the day would come when all the slaves would be. He thought he would live to see it. He thought it was going to happen in 1808. They wrote it into the Constitution that after 1808, essentially, it would be the end of slavery. They believed it would be the end of slavery. That in the Constitution, it says that commerce cannot continue after 1808. No more slaves to be imported. They thought it would kill off the trade. It didn't. Instead, it set up the Civil War, but, you know. So, anyhow, it's fascinating to watch this. And I'm just waiting for somebody to ask one of these guys who says, we should go back to the founders' intent to say, oh, you mean we should decriminalize abortion because it was not illegal when the founders were around. Don't think it's going to happen. I don't think anybody's going to ask that question. I don't see any politicians with the spine to do it, but they should. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you.
And welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion, of course, in 1973. Prior to that, illegal abortions accounted for 13% of all deaths of women in the United States from serious complications. 13%. 13%. Death from abortion is almost unknown in the United States now and in other countries where abortion is legally available. I think I've mentioned before in this program, when I was in high school, there was a woman in my class, I didn't know her personally, well, I knew who she was, who died of an abortion. And that's not an uncommon experience among people, you know, who are in their late 40s, 50s, or 60s, to have that memory. The first law banning abortion in the United States was in Connecticut. There was a statute passed, and then in New York State in 1829. So this was by the time the first law banning abortion was on the books, most of the founders were dead. The first federal law was the Comstock Law of 1873. And this allowed the Postal Service to break open people's mail searching for contraceptive devices. And this led to the rise of anti-contraception laws as well, you know, having to do with the influence of the Catholic Church, which ultimately led to the 1964 or 67 Cunningham versus the state of Connecticut case, as I recall, where a married couple took a case to the Supreme Court saying that they had a right, they had a federal right of privacy to have a condom in their bedroom because it was against the law in Connecticut to own a condom, even if you were a married couple. In 1965, in the United States, there were 265 known deaths because of illegal abortions. Of all pregnancy-related complications in New York and California that year, 20% were due to abortions. Yeah, it was Griswold versus Connecticut. Excuse me, I say Cunningham. It was Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965. That was the case. There we go. I figured it was in there somewhere. That was the case that said, no, you actually, birth control is a right. So, the original intent of the founders was to keep abortion legal. Will that happen? is the founder's original intent going to be respected? Somehow, I doubt it, at least by these folks who keep throwing around the names of the founders to promote their narrow agenda. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Take care.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.